Uisgok gokpanagan, a black ash basket. Dunk, dunk, dunk. Silence. Dunk, dunk, dunk. The back of the axe meets the log to make a hollow music. It drops three times on one spot, and then John's eyes shift a fraction down the log where he strikes again. Dunk, dunk, dunk. As he raises the axe above his head, his hands slide apart on the upstroke, then together on the down, shoulders pulling tight under his chambray shirt, his thin braid jumping with every impact. All the way down the log, he pounds triplets of crushing blows. Straddling the end of the log, he works his fingers under a split in the cut end and gives it a tug. Slow and steady, he peels off a strip of wood the width of the axe head in a thick ribbon. He takes up the axe and pounds another few feet. Dunk, dunk, dunk. Again he grasps the base of the strip and peels it back along the pounded line, taking the log apart, strip by strip. By the time he pounds the last few feet, he has worked off an 8-foot splint of gleaming white wood. He holds it to his nose to breathe in the goodness of new wood and passes it around for us all to see. John coils it into a neat hoop, ties it fast, and hangs it on a nearby tree branch. "Your turn," he says, and hands off the axe. My teacher this warm summer day is John Pigeon, a member of the large, renowned Pigeon family of Potawatomi basket makers. Since that first initiation to pounding a log, I'm grateful to have sat in on black ash basket classes with several generations of the extended family of pigeons, Steve, Kit, Ed, Stephanie, Pearl, Angie, and more, children and grandchildren, with splints in their hands, all gifted basket makers, carriers of culture, and generous teachers. The log is a good teacher, too. It's harder than it looks, making the axe repeat its pattern evenly down the log. Too much impact in one spot will break the fibers. Too little and the strip won't break fully free, leaving a thin spot. Each of us beginners works differently, some with sharp strokes from overhead, some with dull thudding as if we were hammering nails. The sound changes with the pounder, a high ringing note like the call of wild geese, a bark like a startled coyote, the muffled thumping of a drumming grouse. When John was a kid, the sound of log pounding was heard all through the community. Walking home from school, he could tell who was out working by the sound of their swing. Uncle Chester was a hard, fast crack, crack, crack. From across the hedgerow, he could hear Grandma Belle's slow thuds, separated by long pauses while she caught her breath. But now the village grows quieter and quieter as elders walk on, and kids seem more interested in video games than in tromping through the swamp. So John Pigeon teaches any who will come to pass on what he's learned from his elders and the trees. John is both a master basket maker and a carrier of tradition. Pigeon family baskets can be found in the Smithsonian and other museums and galleries around the world, but they are also available here at the family's booth at the annual Potawatomi Gathering of Nations. Their table is loaded with colorful baskets, no two alike. There are fancy baskets the size of a bird's nest, gathering baskets, potato baskets, corn washing baskets. His whole family weaves, and no one at the gathering wants to go home without a pigeon basket. I save up each year for one. Like the rest of the family, John is also a master teacher, committed to sharing what has been passed on by generations who came before. What was given to him, he now gives back to the people. Some basket classes I've taken start with a neat pile of materials, all assembled on a clean table. But John doesn't hold with teaching basket weaving, where the splints come ready-made. He teaches basket making, beginning with a living tree. Black ash, Fraxinus nigra, likes to have its feet wet. In floodplain forests and edges of swamps, Black ash mingles with red maples, elms, and willows. It's never the most common tree. You only find it in scattered patches. So it can take a long day of tromping over boot-sucking ground to find the right tree. Scanning a wet forest, you can pick out the black ash by its bark. You pass by maples with bark of rigid gray plates, the braided corky ridges of elm, the deeply furrowed willows, and instead seek out the fine pattern of interlocked ridges and warty knobs of black ash. The knobs feel spongy under your fingertips when you give them a squeeze. There are other species of ash growing in the swamp, so it's good to check the leaves overhead as well. All ashes, green, white, blue, pumpkin, and black, have compound leaves borne opposite one another on stout, corky twigs. And yet it's not enough to simply find black ash. It has to be the right one, a tree ready to be a basket. An ideal basket ash has a straight, clear bole with no branches in the lower trunk. Branches make knots that interrupt the straight grain of the splint. A good tree is about a hand's breadth across, the crown full and vigorous, a healthy tree. A tree that has grown directly up toward the sun will be straight and fine-grained, while those that have wandered a bit to find the light show twists and turns in the grain. Some basket makers will choose only trees perched on a hummock in the swamp, while others will avoid a black ash growing next to a cedar. Trees are affected by their sapling days as much as people are by their childhoods. The history of a tree appears in its growth rings, of course. Good years yield a wide ring, poor years a thin one, and the pattern of rings is critical to the process of basket making. Growth rings are formed by the cycle of the seasons, by the waking and resting of the fragile layer of cells that lies between the bark and the newest wood, the cambium. Peel away the bark and you feel the cambium's slippery wetness. The cells of the cambium are perpetually embryonic, always dividing to add to the girth of the tree. In the spring, when the buds detect the lengthening of the days and the sap starts to rise, the cambium grows cells made for feast days, big, wide-mouthed tubes to carry the abundant water leafward. These lines of large vessels are what you count to determine a tree's age. They grow quickly, and so their walls tend to be thin. Wood scientists call this part of the annual ring springwood or early wood. When spring turns to summer, nutrients and water become scarce, and the cambium produces smaller, thicker cells for leaner times. These densely packed cells are called late wood or summer wood. When the days shorten and leaves fall, the cambium settles in for a winter's rest and stops dividing altogether. But as soon as spring is imminent, the cambium once again bursts into action, making large springwood cells. The abrupt transition between a last year's small-celled late wood and the early wood of spring creates the appearance of a line, a growth ring. John has developed a practiced eye for these things, but sometimes, just to be sure, he'll unsheath his knife and cut out a wedge for a look at the rings. John prefers a tree in the range of 30 to 40 growth rings, each ring as wide as a nickel. When he's found the right one, the harvest begins. Not with a saw, though, but rather with a conversation. Traditional harvesters recognize the individuality of each tree as a person, a non-human forest person. Trees are not taken, but requested. Respectfully, the cutter explains his purpose, and the tree is asked permission for harvest. Sometimes the answer is no. It might be a cue in the surroundings, a vireo nest in the branches, or the bark's adamant resistance to the questioning knife that suggests a tree is not willing, or it might be the ineffable knowing that turns him away. If consent is granted, a prayer is made, and tobacco is left as a reciprocating gift. The tree is felled with great care so as not to damage it or others in the fall. Sometimes a cutter will make a bed of spruce boughs to cushion the landing of the tree. When they finish, John and his son hoist the log to their shoulders and begin the long walk home. John and his extended family make a lot of baskets. His mother prefers to pound her own log, although he and the boys will often do it when her arthritis is bothering her. They'll weave all year round, but there are certain seasons for the best harvest. It's a good idea to pound a log soon after harvest, while it is still moist, although John says you can bury a log in a trench covered with damp earth to keep it fresh. His favorite times are spring, when the sap is rising and the energy of the earth is flowing into the tree, and fall, when the energy is flowing back to the ground. Today, John scales away the spongy bark, which would deflect the power of the axe, and gets to work. When he pulls the edge of the first strip, you can see what's happening. Beating the log crushes the thin-walled cells of the early wood, breaking them down and separating them from the late wood. The log fractures at the dividing line between spring wood and summer, so the strip that peels off is the wood between annual rings. Depending on the individual history of the tree and its pattern of rings, a strip might come off carrying the wood of 5 years, or sometimes just one. Every tree is different, but as the basket makers pound and peel, he is always moving back through time. The tree's life is coming off in his hands, layer by layer. As the hoops of splint grow more numerous, the log itself grows smaller, and within hours is a skinny pole. See, John shows us, we've stripped all the way back to the time it was a sapling. He gestures to the big pile of splint we've accumulated. Don't ever forget that. It's the whole life of a tree that you've got piled up there. The long strips of wood vary in thickness, so the next step is splitting the strip into its component layers, further separating the annual rings. Thick splints are needed for a big laundry hamper or a trapper's pack basket. The finest fancy baskets use only a ribbon of less than 1 year's wood. From the back of his new white pickup, John pulls out his splitters, two pieces of wood joined with a clamp to make what looks like a giant clothespin. He sits on the edge of his chair and holds the splitter between his knees so its open legs are on the ground and the peaked end rises from his lap. He threads a full 8-foot length of splint up through the clamp and fastens it there with an inch or so protruding. He flicks open his knife and wedges the blade into the cut end of the strip, wiggling it along the growth ring to open a cut. His brown hands grasp either side of the cut, and he pulls them apart in a smooth motion, yielding strips as smooth and even as two long blades of grass. "That's all there is to it," he says. But there's laughter in his eyes as they meet mine. I thread the splint, try to balance the splitter steady between my thighs, and then make the cut that will start the split. I quickly discover that you need to grip the splitter hard between your legs, something I can barely manage. "Yep," John laughs. "This is an old Indian invention, the thigh master." By the time I'm through, my splint looks like a chipmunk has been gnawing on the end. John is a patient teacher, but he won't do it for me. He just smiles, smartly severs my frayed end, and says, "Try it again." Eventually, I get two sides that I can pull, but they're uneven, and my pulling yields only a 12-inch splinter, thin on one side, thick on the other. John circles among us, offering encouragement. He has learned everyone's name and picked up something of what each one of us needs. Some he joshes about their weak biceps. Others he pats warmly on the shoulder. With the frustrated, he sits gently alongside and says, "Don't try so hard. Be easier on yourself." For others, he just pulls the strip and gives it to them. He's as good a judge of people as he is of trees. "This tree is a good teacher," he says. "That's what we've always been taught. The work of being a human is finding balance, and making splints will not let you forget it." When you get the hang of it, the splint pulls apart evenly, the inner faces of the splint unexpectedly beautiful. Glossy and warm, they catch the light like a ribbon of cream satin. The outer surface is uneven and roughened with splintered ends that leave long hairs. You need a very sharp knife now, he says. I have to use the whetstone every day, and it's awful easy to cut yourself. John hands each of us a leg, cut from worn blue jeans, and shows us how to lay the double thickness of denim over our left thighs. Deerskin is really the best thing to use, he says, if you've got some lying around. But blue jeans work fine. Just be careful. He sits with us individually to demonstrate, for the difference between success and bloodshed is a small degree in the angle of the knife and the pressure of the hand. He lays the strip across his thigh, rough side up, and sets the knife edge against it. With his other hand, he draws the strip out from beneath the knife in a continuous motion like a skate blade skimming over ice. The shavings gather on the knife as the strip pulls by. The result is a polished surface. This, too, he makes look easy. I've seen Kit Pigeon pull satiny strips as if she was pulling ribbon from a spool, but my knife snags, and I end up cutting gouges instead of planing it smooth. The angle of my knife is too sharp, and I cut right through, rendering a long, pretty strip into a scrap. You're about up to a loaf of bread, John says, shaking his head when I ruin yet another piece. That's what my mother would say when we spoiled splints. Basket making was, and is, the livelihood of the Pigeon family. In their grandfather's time, the lake, woods, and gardens gave them most of their food and other provisions. But at times they also needed store goods, and baskets were the cash crop that bought bread, canned peaches, and school shoes. Spoiled splints were like food thrown away. Depending on the size and design, a black ash basket can sell for good money. People get a little mad when they see the prices, John says. People think it's just basket weaving, but 80% of the work comes long before you weave. With finding the tree, pounding and pulling and all, you barely make minimum wage. With splints finally prepared, we're poised for weaving, what we had mistakenly thought was the real work of a basket. But John stops the class, his gentle voice gaining a hard edge. You've missed the most important thing, he says. Look around you. We look. At the forest, at the camp, at each other, at the ground, he says. In a circle around each novice is a litter of scraps. Stop and think what you're holding. That ash tree was growing out there in that swamp for 30 years, putting out leaves, dropping them, putting out more. It got eaten by deer, hit by a freeze, but it kept working year in and year out, laying down those rings of wood. A splint fallen on the ground is a whole year of that tree's life, and you're about to step on it, bend it, grind it into the dirt. That tree honored you with its life. There's no shame in messing up a splint. You're just learning. But whatever you do, you owe that tree respect, and you should never waste it. And so he guides us as we sort through the debris we've made. Short strips go into a pile for small baskets and decoration. The miscellaneous bits and shavings get tossed into a box to be dried and used for tinder. John keeps to the tradition of the honorable harvest. Take only what you need, and use everything that you take. His words echo what I've often heard from my folks. They grew up during the Depression, with the imperative not to waste, and there were certainly no scraps on the floor then. But use it up, wear it out, make it do, or do without, is an ethic both economical and ecological. The waste of splints both dishonors the tree and diminishes the household budget. Just about everything we use is the result of another's life, but that simple reality is rarely acknowledged in our society. The ash curls we make are almost paper thin. They say that the waste stream in this country is dominated by paper. Just as much as an ash splint, a sheet of paper is a tree's life, along with the water and energy and toxic byproducts that went into making it. And yet we use it as if it were nothing. The short path from mailbox to waste bin tells the story. But what would happen, I wonder, to the mountain of junk mail if we could see in it the trees it had once been, if John were there to remind us of the worthiness of their lives? In some parts of the range, basket makers began to observe a decline in the numbers of black ash. They worried that over-harvesting might be to blame, a decline caused by too much attention for the baskets in the marketplace and too little for their sources in the woods. My graduate student, Tom Touche, and I decided to investigate. We began by analyzing the population structure of black ashes around us in New York State to understand where in the tree's life cycle the difficulty might lie. In every swamp we visited, we counted all the black ash we could find and wrapped a tape around them to get their size. Tom cored a few in every site to check their ages. In stand after stand, Tom found that there were old trees and seedlings, but hardly any trees in between. There was a big hole in the demographic census. He found plenty of seeds, plenty of young seedlings, but most of the next age class, the saplings, the future of the forest, were dead or missing. There were only two places where he found an abundance of adolescent trees. One was in gaps in the forest canopy, where disease or a windstorm had brought down a few old trees, letting light through. Curiously enough, he found that where Dutch elm disease had killed off elms, black ash was replacing them in a balance between loss of one species and gain of another. To make the transition from seedling to tree, the young black ash needed an opening. If they remained in full shade, they would die. The other place where saplings were thriving was near communities of basket makers. Where the tradition of black ash basketry was alive and well, so were the trees. We hypothesized that the apparent decline in ash trees might be due not to over-harvesting, but to under-harvesting. When communities echoed with dunk, 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 there were plenty of basket makers in the woods, creating gaps where the light would reach the seedlings and the young trees could shoot to the canopy and become adults. In places where the basket makers disappeared, or were few, the forest didn't get opened up enough for black ash to flourish. Black ash and basket makers are partners in a symbiosis between harvesters and harvested. Ash relies on people as the people rely on ash. Their fates are linked. The pigeons' teaching of this linkage is part of a growing movement to revive traditional basketry, tied to the revitalization of indigenous lands, language, culture, and philosophies. All over Turtle Island, Native peoples are leading a resurgence in traditional knowledge and lifeways that nearly disappeared under the pressure of newcomers. But just as the revival of ash basketry is gaining strength, it's being threatened by yet another invading species. John sends us off for a break, a cool drink, and a stretch for tired fingers. "You need a clear mind for the next part," he says. As we mill about, shaking out the cramps in our necks and hands, John gives us each a U.S. Department of Agriculture pamphlet with a photo of a shiny green beetle on the cover. "If you care about ash trees," he said, "you better pay attention. They're under attack." The emerald ash borer, introduced from China, lays its eggs in tree trunks. After the larvae hatch, they chew up the cambium until they pupate, when the beetle bores its way out of the tree and flies off to find a new nursery. But wherever it lands, it is inevitably fatal for the infested trees. Unfortunately for the people of the Great Lakes region and New England, the beetle's favorite host is ash. Today there's a quarantine on moving logs and firewood in an effort to contain their spread, but the insect is moving faster than scientists predicted. So be on the lookout, John says. We have to protect our trees. That's our job. When he and his family are harvesting logs in the fall, they take special care to gather up fallen seeds and spread them around as they move through the wetlands. It's like anything else, he reminds us. You can't take something without giving back. This tree takes care of us, so we have to take care of it. Already vast areas of ash in Michigan have died. Beloved basket grounds are now boneyards of barkless trees. There is a rupture in the chain of relationship that stretches back through time immemorial. The swamp where the pigeons have gathered and cared for black ash for generations is now infested. Angie Pigeon writes, "Our trees are all gone. I don't know if there will be any more baskets." To most people, an invasive species represents losses in a landscape, the empty spaces to be filled by something else. To those who carry the responsibility of an ancient relationship, the empty niche means empty hands and a hole in the collective heart. Now, when so many trees have fallen and the tradition passed on by generations is at risk, the pigeons work to protect both trees and the tradition. They are partnering with forest scientists to resist the insect and to adapt to its aftermath. There are reweavers among us. John and his family are not alone in their efforts to protect the black ash. At Akwesasne, a Mohawk reserve that straddles the border between New York State and Canada, black ash has yet more guardians. Over the past 3 decades, Les Benedict, Richard David, and Mike Bridgen have led an effort to bring traditional ecological knowledge as well as scientific tools to bear in the protection of black ash. They have grown thousands of black ash seedlings to give away to indigenous communities throughout the region. Les even convinced the New York State Tree Nursery to grow them for planting in places ranging from schoolyards to Superfund sites. Thousands had already been planted in resurgent forests, in resurgent communities, just as the ash borer appeared on our shores. As the threat wings its way closer to their homelands every fall, Les and his colleagues gather the willing and collect the best seeds they can find, storing seed to keep faith with the future, to replant the forest after the wave of invasion has passed. Every species needs its Les Benedict, its pigeon family, its allies and protectors. Many of our traditional teachings recognize that certain species are our helpers and guides. The original instructions remind us that we must return the favor. It's an honor to be the guardian of another species, an honor within each person's reach that we too often forget. A black ash basket is a gift that reminds us of the gifts of other beings, gifts we can gratefully return through advocacy and care. John calls us back to the circle for the next step, assembling the bottom of the basket. We're doing a traditional round bottom, so the first 2 strips are laid out at right angles in a symmetrical cross. Easy. Now take a look at what you've done, John says. You've started with the 4 directions in front of you. It's the heart of your basket. Everything else is built around that. Our people honor the 4 sacred directions and the powers resident there. Where the 2 basket strips meet, at the intersection of the 4 directions, is right where we stand as humans, trying to find balance among them. See there, John says, everything we do in life is sacred. The 4 directions are what we build on. That's why we start like that. Once the 8 spokes of the framework are twined into place with the thinnest possible strips, each basket begins to grow. We look to John for the next set of instructions, but there are none. He says, "You're on your own now. The design of the basket is up to you. No one can tell you what to create." We have thick and thin splints to work with, and John shakes out a bag full of brightly dyed splints in every color. The tangled pile looks like the singing ribbons on the men's ribbon shirts in the evening powwows. Just think of the tree, and all its hard work before you start, he says. It gave its life for this basket, so you know your responsibility. Make something beautiful in return. Responsibility to the tree makes everyone pause before beginning. Sometimes I have that same sense when I face a blank sheet of paper. For me, writing is an act of reciprocity with the world. It's what I can give back in return for everything that has been given to me. And now there's another layer of responsibility, writing on a thin sheet of tree and hoping the words are worth it. Such a thought could make a person set down her pen. The first two rows of the basket are the hardest. On the first go-round, the splint seems to have a will of its own and wants to wander from the over-under rhythm around the circle. It resists the pattern and looks all loose and wobbly. This is when John steps in to help, offering encouragement and a steady hand to anchor the escaping splints. The second row is almost as frustrating. The spacing is all wrong, and you have to clamp the weaver in place to get it to stay. Even then, it comes loose and slaps you in the face with its wet end. John just laughs. It is a mess of unruly pieces, nothing like a whole. And then there's the third row, my favorite. At this point, the tension of over is balanced by the tension of under, and the opposing forces start to come into balance. The give and take, reciprocity, begins to take hold, and the parts begin to become a whole. The weaving becomes easy as splints fall snugly into place. Order and stability emerge out of chaos. In weaving well-being for land and people, we need to pay attention to the lessons of the three rows. Ecological well-being and the laws of nature are always the first row. Without them, there is no basket of plenty. Only if that first circle is in place can we weave the second. The second reveals material welfare, the subsistence of human needs, economy built upon ecology. But with only two rows in place, the basket is still in jeopardy of pulling apart. It's only when the third row comes that the first two can hold together. Here is where ecology, economics, and spirit are woven together. By using materials as if they were a gift and returning that gift through worthy use, we find balance. I think that third row goes by many names: respect, reciprocity, all our relations. I think of it as the spirit row. Whatever the name, the three rows represent recognition that our lives depend on one another. Human needs being only one row in the basket that must hold us all. In relationship, the separate splints become a whole basket, sturdy and resilient enough to carry us into the future. While we're working, a gaggle of little kids come by to watch. John is pulled in many directions to help us all, but he stops and gives his full attention to the boys. They're too little to join in, but they want to be there, so he takes up a handful of the short strips from our debris. His hands, now deliberate and slow, bend and twist the strips until a few minutes later, a little toy horse sits in the palm of his hand. He gives the boys some scraps, the model, and a few words in Potawatomi, but doesn't tell them how to make a horse. They're used to this kind of teaching and don't ask questions. They look, and look some more, and then set to work to figure it out. Before long, a herd of horses is galloping over the table, and little boys are watching baskets grow. Toward the end of the afternoon, in the lengthening shadows, the work table begins to fill with completed baskets. John helps us add the decorative curls that are traditional on small baskets. The black ash ribbons are so flexible that you can embroider the surface of the basket with loops and twists that show off the glossy sheen of the ash. We've made low round trays, tall thin vases, plump apple baskets, and textures and colors of every kind. Here's the last step, he says, handing out Sharpie markers. You've got to sign your basket. Take pride in what you did. That basket didn't make itself. Claim it, mistakes and all. He makes us line up for a photograph, all holding our baskets. This is a special occasion, he says, beaming like a proud father. Look what you've learned today. I want you to see what the baskets have shown you. Every one of them is beautiful. Every one of them is different. And yet every one of them began in the same tree. They are all made of the same stuff, and yet each is itself. That's the way it is with our people, too. All made of the same thing, and each their own kind of beautiful. That night, I see the powwow circle with new eyes. I notice that the cedar arbor sheltering the drums is supported by poles set in the four directions. The drum, the heartbeat, calls us out to dance. There is one beat, but each dancer has a distinctive step. Dipping grass dancers, crouching buffalo dancers, the twirl of fancy shawl dancers, high-stepping jingle dress girls, the dignified pace of the women's traditional dancers. Each man, each woman, each child, all dressed in their dreamed-of colors, ribbons flying, fringes swaying, all beautiful, all dancing to the heartbeat. Around the circle we go, all night, together weaving a basket. Today my house is full of baskets, and my favorites are pigeons. In them I can hear John's voice, can hear the dunk, 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 and smell the swamp. They remind me of the years of a tree's life that I hold in my hands. What would it be like, I wonder, to live with that heightened sensitivity to the lives given for ours? To consider the tree in the Kleenex, the algae in the toothpaste, the oaks in the floor, the grapes in the wine, to follow back the thread of life in everything and pay it respect. Once you start, it's hard to stop, and you begin to feel yourself awash in gifts. I open the cupboard. A likely place for gifts, I think. I greet you, jar of jam, you glass who once was sand upon the beach, washed back and forth and bathed in foam and seagull cries, but who are formed into glass until you once again return to the sea. And you, berries, plump in your June-ness, now in my February pantry. And you, sugar, so far from your Caribbean home. Thanks for making the trip. In that awareness, looking over the objects on my desk, the basket, the candle, the paper, I delight in following their origins back to the ground. I twirl a pencil, a magic wand lathed from incense cedar between my fingers. The willow bark and the aspirin, even the metal of my lamp, ask me to consider its roots in the strata of the earth. But I notice that my eyes and my thoughts pass quickly over the plastic on my desk. I hardly give the computer a second glance. I can muster no reflective moment for plastic. It is so far removed from the natural world. I wonder if that's a place where the disconnection began, the loss of respect, when we could no longer easily see the life within the object. And yet I mean no disrespect for the diatoms and marine invertebrates who 200 million years ago lived well and fell to the bottom of an ancient sea where under great pressure of a shifting earth they became oil that was pumped from the ground to a refinery where it was broken down and then polymerized to make the case of my laptop or the cap of the aspirin bottle. But being mindful in the vast network of hyper-industrialized goods really gives me a headache. We weren't made for that sort of constant awareness. We've got work to do. But every once in a while, with a basket in hand, or a peach, or a pencil, there is that moment when the mind and spirit open to all the connections, to all the lives, and our responsibility to use them well. And just in that moment, I can hear John Pigeon say, "Slow down. It's 30 years of a tree's life you've got in your hands there. Don't you owe it a few minutes to think about what you'll do with it? Mishkos Kenamogwin, The Teachings of Grass. 1. Introduction. You can smell it before you see it, a sweet grass meadow on a summer day. The scent flickers on the breeze. You sniff like a dog on a scent, and then it's gone, replaced by the boggy tang of wet ground. And then it's back, the sweet vanilla fragrance beckoning. 2. Literature Review. Lena is not fooled easily, though. She wanders into the meadow with the certainty of her years, parting grasses with her slender form. A tiny, gray-haired elder, she is up to her waist in grass. She casts her gaze over all the other species, and then makes a beeline to a patch that to the uninitiated looks like all the rest. She runs a ribbon of grass through the thumb and forefinger of her wrinkled brown hand. See how glossy it is. It can hide from you among the others, but it wants to be found. That's why it shines like this. But she passes this patch by, letting it slide through her fingers. She obeys the teachings of her ancestors to never take the first plant that you see. I follow behind her as her hands trail lovingly over the bone set and the goldenrod. She spies a gleam in the sward, and her step quickens. Ah, bonjour, she says. Hello. From the pocket of her old nylon jacket, she takes her pouch, deerskin, with a beaded red edge, and shakes a little tobacco into the palm of her hand. Eyes closed, murmuring. She raises a hand to the four directions, and then scatters the tobacco to the ground. You know this, she says, her eyebrows a question mark, to always leave a gift for the plants, to ask if we might take them. It would be rude not to ask first. Only then does she stoop and pinch off a grass stem at its base, careful not to disturb the roots. She parts the nearby clumps, finding another and another until she has gathered a thick sheaf of shining stems. A winding path marks her progress where the meadow canopy was opened by the trail of her passage. She passes right by many dense patches, leaving them to sway in the breeze. It's our way, she says, to take only what we need. I've always been told that you never take more than half. Sometimes she doesn't take any at all, but just comes here to check on the meadow, to see how the plants are doing. Our teachings, she says, are very strong. They wouldn't get handed on if they weren't useful. The most important thing to remember is what my grandmother always said. If we use a plant respectfully, it will stay with us and flourish. If we ignore it, it will go away. If you don't give it respect, it will leave us. The plants themselves have shown this. Mishkos Kenamogwin. As we leave the meadow for the path back through the woods, she twists a handful of timothy into a loose knot upon itself, beside the trail. This tells other pickers that have been here, she says, so that they know not to take any more. This place always gives good sweetgrass, since we tend to it right. But the other places, it's getting hard to find. I'm thinking they might not be picking right. Some people, they're in a hurry, and they pull up the whole plant. Even the roots come up. It's not the way I was taught. I've been with pickers who did that, yanking up a handful that left a little bare spot in the turf and a fuzz of broken roots on the uprooted stems. They too made offerings of tobacco and took only half, and they assured me that their method of picking was the correct one. They were defensive about the charges that their harvesting was depleting sweetgrass. I asked Lena about it. She just shrugged. 3. Hypothesis. In many places, sweetgrass is disappearing from its historic locales, so the basket makers had a request for the botanists. to see if the different ways of harvesting might be the cause of sweetgrass's leaving. I want to help, but I'm a little wary. Sweetgrass is not an experimental unit for me. It's a gift. There's a barrier of language and meaning between science and traditional knowledge. Different ways of knowing, different ways of communicating. I'm not sure I want to force the teachings on grass into the tight uniform of scientific thinking and technical writing that is required of the academy. Introduction. Literature review. Hypothesis. Methods. Results. Discussion. Conclusions. Acknowledgements. References cited. But I've been asked on behalf of Sweetgrass, and I know my responsibility. To be heard, you must speak the language of the one you want to listen. So back at school, I proposed the idea as a thesis project to my graduate student, Lori. Not content with purely academic questions, she had been looking for a research project that would, as she said, mean something to someone instead of just sitting on the shelf. 4. Methods. Lori was eager to begin, but she hadn't met sweetgrass before. "It's the grass that will teach you," I advised, "so you have to get to know it." I took her out to our restored sweetgrass meadows, and it was love at first sniff. It didn't take her long to recognize sweetgrass after that. It was as if the plant wanted her to find it. Together, we designed experiments to compare the effects of the two harvesting methods the basket makers had explained. Lori's education so far was full of the scientific method, but I wanted her to live out a slightly different style of research. To me, an experiment is a kind of conversation with plants. I have a question for them, but since we don't speak the same language, I can't ask them directly, and they won't answer verbally. But plants can be eloquent in their physical responses and behaviors. Plants answer questions by the way they live, by their responses to change. You just need to learn how to ask. I smile when I hear my colleagues say, "I discovered X." That's kind of like Columbus claiming to have discovered America. It was here all along. It's just that he didn't know it. Experiments are not about discovery, but about listening and translating the knowledge of other beings. My colleagues might scoff at the notion of basket makers as scientists, but when Lena and her daughters take 50% of the sweetgrass, observe the result, evaluate their findings, and then create management guidelines from them, that sounds a lot like experimental science to me. Generations of data collection and validation through time builds up to well-tested theories. At my university, as at many others, graduate students must present their thesis ideas to a faculty committee. Lori did a wonderful job of outlining the proposed experiment, ably describing multiple study sites, the many replicates, and intensive sampling techniques. But when she was through speaking, there was an uneasy silence in the conference room. One professor shuffled through the proposal pages and pushed them aside dismissively. "I don't see anything new here for science," he said. "There's not even a theoretical framework." A theory, to scientists, means something rather different from its popular use, which suggests something speculative or untested. A scientific theory is a cohesive body of knowledge, an explanation that is consistent among a range of cases and can allow you to predict what might happen in unknown situations, like this one. Our research was most definitely grounded in theory. Lena's primarily, in the traditional ecological knowledge of indigenous peoples. If we use a plant respectfully, it will flourish. If we ignore it, it will go away. This is a theory generated from millennia of observations of plant response to harvest, subject to peer review by generations of practitioners, from basket makers to herbalists. Despite the weight of this truth, the committee could only struggle not to roll their eyes. The dean looked over the glasses that had slid down his nose, fixing Laurie with a pointed stare and directing a sidelong glance toward me. Anyone knows that harvesting a plant will damage the population. You're wasting your time. And I'm afraid I don't find this whole traditional knowledge thing very convincing. Like the former school teacher she was, Laurie was unfailingly calm and gracious as she explained further, but her eyes were steely. Later, though, they were filled with tears. Mine, too. In the early years, no matter how carefully you prepared, this was nearly a rite of passage for women scientists. The condescension, the verbal smackdown from academic authorities, especially if you had the audacity to ground your work in the observations of old women who had probably not finished high school and talked to plants to boot. Getting scientists to consider the validity of indigenous knowledge is like swimming upstream in cold, cold water. They've been so conditioned to be skeptical of even the hardest of hard data that bending their minds toward theories that are verified without the expected graphs or equations is tough. Couple that with the unblinking assumption that science has cornered the market on truth, and there's not much room for discussion. Undeterred, we carried on. The basket makers had given us the prerequisites of the scientific method: observation, pattern, and a testable hypothesis. That sounded like science to me. So we began by setting up experimental plots in the meadows to ask the plants the question: do these two different harvest methods contribute to decline? And then we tried to detect their answer. We chose dense sweetgrass stands where the population had been restored, rather than compromising native stands where pickers were active. With incredible patience, Laurie did a census of the sweetgrass population in every plot to obtain precise measures of population density prior to harvest. She even marked individual stems of grass with colored plastic ties to keep track of them. When all had been tallied, she then began the harvest. The plots were subject to one of the two harvest methods the basket makers had described. Laurie took half the stems in each plot, pinching them off one by one carefully at the base in some plots, and yanking up a tuft and leaving a small ragged gap in the sod in others. Experiments must have controls, of course, so she left an equal number of plots alone and did not harvest them at all. Pink flagging festooned the meadows to mark her study areas. One day in the field, we sat in the sun and talked about whether the method really duplicated the traditional harvest. "I know that it doesn't," she said, "because I'm not replicating the relationship. I don't speak to the plants or make an offering." She had wrestled with this, but settled on excluding it. "I honor that traditional relationship, but I couldn't ever do it as part of an experiment. It wouldn't be right on any level to add a variable that I don't understand and that science can't even attempt to measure. And besides, I'm not qualified to speak to sweetgrass." Later, she admitted that it was hard to stay neutral in her research and avoid affection for the plants after so many days among them, learning and listening. Neutrality proved impossible. Eventually, she was just careful to show them all her mindful respect, making her care constant as well, so that she would not sway the results one way or the other. The sweetgrass she harvested was counted, weighed, and given away to basket makers. Every few months, Laurie counted and marked all the grass in her plots, dead shoots, living ones, and brand new shoots just pushing up from the ground. She charted the birth, the death, and the reproduction of all of her grass stems. When the next July rolled around, she harvested once more, just as women were doing in the native stands. For 2 years, she harvested and measured the response of the grass, along with a team of student interns. It was a little tough at first to recruit student helpers, given that their task would be watching grass grow. 5. Results. Lori observed carefully and filled her notebook with measurements, charting the vigor of each plot. She worried a little when the control plots were looking a little sickly. She was relying on these controls, the unharvested patches, to be the reference point for comparing the effects of harvesting in the other plots. We hoped they would perk up when spring came. By the second year, Lori was expecting her first child. The grass grew and grew, as did her belly. Bending and stooping became a little more difficult, to say nothing of lying in the grass to read plant tags. But she was faithful to her plants, sitting in the dirt among them, counting and marking. She said the quiet of field work, the calm of sitting in a flower-strewn meadow with the smell of sweetgrass all around, was a good beginning for the baby. I think she was right. As the summer wore on, it became a race to finish the research before the baby was born. Just weeks away from delivery, it became a team effort. When Lori was done with a plot, she would call out for her field crew to help hoist her to her feet. This, too, was a rite of passage for women field biologists. As her baby grew, Lori came to believe with increasing conviction in the knowledge of her basket-making mentors, recognizing, as Western science often does not, the quality of observations from the women who had long had close relationships with plants and their habitats. They shared many of their teachings with her, and they knit many baby hats. Baby Celia was born in the early fall, and a braid of sweetgrass was hung over her crib. While Celia slept nearby, Lori put her data on the computer and began to make the comparisons between the harvesting methods. From the twist ties on every stem, Lori could chart the births and deaths in the sample plots. Some plots were full of new young shoots that signaled a thriving population, and some were not. Her statistical analyses were all sound and thorough, but she hardly needed graphs to tell the story. From across the field, you could see the difference. Some plots gleamed shiny golden green, and some were dull and brown. The committee's criticism hovered in her mind. Anyone knows that harvesting a plant will damage the population. The surprise was that the failing plots were not the harvested ones, as predicted, but the unharvested controls. The sweetgrass that had not been picked or disturbed in any way was choked with dead stems, while the harvested plots were thriving. Even though half of all stems had been harvested each year, they quickly grew back, completely replacing everything that had been gathered, in fact, producing more shoots than were present before harvest. Picking sweetgrass seemed to actually stimulate growth. In the first year's harvest, the plants that grew the very best were the ones that had been yanked up in a handful. But whether it was pinched singly or pulled in a clump, the end result was nearly the same. It didn't seem to matter how the grass was harvested, only that it was. Lori's graduate committee had dismissed this possibility from the outset. They had been taught that harvesting causes decline. And yet the grasses themselves unequivocally argued the opposite point. After the grilling Lori received over her research proposal, you might imagine she was dreading the thesis defense. But she had one thing skeptical scientists value most: data. While Celia slept in her proud father's arms, Lori presented her graphs and tables to demonstrate that sweetgrass flourishes when it's harvested and declines when it is not. The doubting Dean was silent. The basket makers smiled. 6. Discussion. We are all the product of our worldviews, even scientists who claim pure objectivity. Their predictions for Sweetgrass were consistent with their Western science worldview, which sets human beings outside of nature and judges their interactions with other species as largely negative. They had been schooled that the best way to protect a dwindling species was to leave it alone and keep people away. But the grassy meadows tell us that for Sweetgrass, human beings are part of the system, a vital part. Lori's findings might have been surprising to academic ecologists, but were consistent with the theory voiced by our ancestors. If we use a plant respectfully, it will stay with us and flourish. If we ignore it, it will go away. Your experiment seems to demonstrate a significant effect, said the dean. But how do you explain it? Are you implying that the grass that was unharvested had its feelings hurt by being ignored? What is the mechanism responsible for this? Lori admitted that the scientific literature held no explanations for the relationship between basket makers and Sweetgrass, since such questions were not generally deemed worthy of scientific attention. She turned to studies of how grasses respond to other factors, such as fire or grazing. She discovered that the stimulated growth she had observed was well known to range scientists. After all, grasses are beautifully adapted to disturbance. It's why we plant lawns. When we mow them, they multiply. Grasses carry their growing points just beneath the soil surface, so that when their leaves are lost to a mower, a grazing animal, or a fire, they quickly recover. She explained how harvesting thinned the population, allowing the remaining shoots to respond to the extra space and the light by reproducing quickly. Even the pulling method was beneficial. The underground stem that connects the shoots is dotted with buds. When it's gently tugged, the stem breaks, and all those buds produce thrifty young shoots to fill the gap. Many grasses undergo a physiological change known as compensatory growth, in which the plant compensates for loss of foliage by quickly growing more. It seems counterintuitive, but when a herd of buffalo grazes down a sward of fresh grass, it actually grows faster in response. This helps the plants recover, but also invites the buffalo back for dinner later in the season. It's even been discovered that there is an enzyme in the saliva of grazing buffalo that actually stimulates grass growth, to say nothing of the fertilizer produced by a passing herd. Grass gives to buffalo, and buffalo give to grass. The system is well balanced, but only if the herd uses the grass respectfully. Free-range buffalo graze and move on, not returning to the same place for many months. Thus they obey the rule of not taking more than half, of not overgrazing. Why shouldn't it also be true for people in Sweetgrass? We are no more than the buffalo, and no less, governed by the same natural laws. With a long, long history of cultural use, Sweetgrass has apparently become dependent on humans to create the disturbance that stimulates its compensatory growth. Humans participate in a symbiosis in which Sweetgrass provides its fragrant blades to the people, and people, by harvesting, create the conditions for Sweetgrass to flourish. It's intriguing to wonder whether the regional decline in Sweetgrass might be due not to over-harvesting, but rather to under-harvesting. Lori and I pored over the map of historical locations for Sweetgrass, created by a former student, Daniela Shevitz. There were blue dots where Sweetgrass used to be found, but has since disappeared. Red dots marked the few places where sweetgrass was reported historically and where it is still thriving. These red dots are not randomly scattered. They're clustered around native communities, particularly those known for their sweetgrass basketry. Sweetgrass thrives where it is used and disappears elsewhere. Science and traditional knowledge may ask different questions and speak different languages, but they may also converge when both truly listen to the plants. To relate the story the ancestors told us to the academics in the room, however, we needed to use scientific explanations expressed in the language of mechanism and objectification. If we remove 50% of the plant biomass, the stems are released from resource competition. The stimulus of compensatory growth causes an increase in population density and plant vigor. In the absence of disturbance, resource depletion and competition result in a loss of vigor and increased mortality. The scientists gave Lori a warm round of applause. She had spoken their language and made a convincing case for the stimulatory effect of harvesters, indeed, for the reciprocity between harvesters and sweetgrass. One even retracted his initial criticism that this research would add nothing new to science. The basket makers who sat at the table simply nodded their heads in agreement. Wasn't this just as the elders have said? The question was, how do we show respect? Sweetgrass told us the answer as we experimented. Sustainable harvesting can be the way we treat a plant with respect, by respectfully receiving its gift. Perhaps it is no coincidence that it is sweetgrass that reveals this story. Wingoshk was the first to be planted by Sky Woman on the back of Turtle Island. The grass gives its fragrant self to us, and we receive it with gratitude. In return, through the very act of accepting the gift, the pickers open some space, let the light come in, and with a gentle tug, bestir the dormant buds that make new grass. Reciprocity is a matter of keeping the gift in motion through self-perpetuating cycles of giving and receiving. Our elders taught that the relationship between plants and humans must be one of balance. People can take too much and exceed the capacity of the plants to share again. That's the voice of hard experience that resonates in the teachings of never take more than half. And yet they also teach that we can take too little. If we allow traditions to die, relationships to fade, the land will suffer. These laws are the product of hard experience, of past mistakes. And not all plants are the same. Each has its own way of regenerating. Some, unlike sweetgrass, are easily harmed by harvest. Lena would say that the key is to know them well enough to respect the difference. 7. Conclusions. With their tobacco and their thanks, our people say to the sweetgrass, I need you. By its renewal after picking, the grass says to the people, I need you too. Mishkos Kenemogwin, isn't this the lesson of grass? Through reciprocity, the gift is replenished. All of our flourishing is mutual. 8. Acknowledgements. In a field of tall grass, with only the wind for company, there is a language that transcends the difference between scientific and traditional understandings, the data, or the prayer. The wind moves through and carries the grass song. It sounds to me like Mishkos, over and over again, on ripples of moving grass. After all, it has taught us, I want to say thank you. 9. References cited. Wingachk, Buffalo, Lena, The Ancestors.